Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kurepko, and I'll be going over five recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top five countdown for the week. At number five, we have PayPal terminating InfoWars' account and giving it 10 days to find a replacement. The company basically jumped on the censorship bandwagon being led by other big tech companies such as Facebook, Twitter, Apple, YouTube, and Spotify, which earlier blocked Alex Jones on the pretext that his allegedly hateful broadcast violate their terms of service. Without the easily accessible means to sell InfoWars merchandise from his website, the radio host will undoubtedly lose precious revenue that could in turn hinder his business, which is exactly what PayPal probably intended when it made this decision. At this point, it's undoubtable that the so-called powers that be, or the masters of the universe like some have recently taken to calling them, are colluding with one another to shut down InfoWars because it goes against their politically correct liberal globalist dogma. InfoWars was also thought to have played an important role in the 2016 election, so it's no surprise that it's being censored in the run-up to this November's midterms in a desperate bid to derail the electoral prospects of Trump's political surrogates, which InfoWars is known for unabashedly supporting. The larger lesson, though, is that big tech is behaving monopolistically within the global information commons and abusing its leading position across several of the world's main platforms in order to engage in political bias that realistically runs the chance of having very real consequences. The masters of the universe are meddling in America's political processes through their selective censorship practices, including so-called shadow banning, which is why the White House reportedly drafted an antitrust executive order to look into this. Even in the best-case scenario that these problems are one day rectified, that'll only be a relief for Americans because the U.S. will probably turn a blind eye to these very same companies interfering in its rivals' political affairs like they're doing in Iran. The harsh reality is that the genie has already been let out of the bottle, so to speak, and short of a worldwide movement away from these platforms, which could also have the unintended consequences of disrupting activist outreaches and reinforcing groupthink, nothing will probably ever change. The next one up is Ugandan opposition icon Bobi Wine returning home after receiving treatment in the U.S. for serious injuries that he said were inflicted during his arrest last month for treason. The popular singer-turned-politician has become a role model for the country's majority teenage population, but was recently accused of participating in a violent attack against a presidential motorcade, though his supporters claim that the state is harassing him because they see him as the greatest threat to long-serving and elderly President Yoweri Museveni's ambitions to stand for a sixth term in 2021. The reality is a lot more complex than Wine being either a so-called freedom fighter or a treasonous terrorist, but before getting to that, a few facts need to be mentioned. The first is that Wine is openly supported by the U.S., as documented in detail by Bangkok-based geopolitical researcher Tony Cartolucci in his recent piece for Journal Neo, and that he's more of a typical color revolutionary demagogue than a serious politician with a clear vision for the future. For better or for worse, Wine and his supporters lack the political experience necessary for managing a country with such serious developmental, political, and security challenges as Uganda, though his appeal is partly due to him being the polar opposite of Museveni. The incumbent leader came out on top in the country's civil war and has prioritized a security-centric domestic policy since then, which he claims has kept Uganda stable, while his detractors allege that it has turned it into a dictatorship. Another point is that Museveni was one of the U.S.'s primary proxies during the disastrous Congo War that ultimately killed upwards of 5 million people but established Uganda as a regional military hegemon. This makes it superficially strange why the US would turn against a trusted ally, but the reality is that Museveni has been trying to balance the US with China over the past decade and is poised to play a pivotal transit role in the East African Silk Road through the possible extension of Kenya's Chinese-built standard gauge railway into his country and beyond to Central Africa. Another point is that the US has an interest in preemptively guiding inevitable leadership transitions, just like it did in Egypt and Tunisia when it betrayed its two trusted partners there. So it's not unprecedented that it would do the same in Uganda too. As such, Bobi Wine has become the US's color revolution figurehead in Uganda, but that doesn't mean that anti-government sentiment in and of itself should be discredited, because the people have more than enough legitimate grievances against Museveni. The most troubling aspect about this, however, is that most of Wine's supporters are teenagers, and manipulating them into carrying out acts of violence against the state could lead to the police being forced to turn their weapons on what are legally classified as children, thus potentially prompting a public relations disaster for Museveni that might be exploited for sanctions purposes. Third on our countdown, we have Trump supposedly making an imaginative suggestion to Spain that it build a wall across the Sahara Desert to keep out illegal immigrants. The Spanish foreign minister revealed that the American president even remarked that the Sahara border can't be bigger than our border with Mexico, which drew much mockery in the liberal globalist mainstream media because the peninsular country only has two very small enclaves in Africa that are located near northern Morocco's mountains and not anywhere close to the Sahara Desert. Instead of being the gaffe that it's being presented as, it could also be that Trump was deliberately drawing attention to a politically incorrect problem in his characteristically dramatic way. Spain's new socialist government doesn't really consider the country to be in any sort of migrant crisis, even though its geography makes it forever susceptible to this scenario. The EU as a whole has finally gotten around to realizing that sub-Saharan Africa presents an immigration challenge many magnitudes greater than anything that Syria ever did, but it's conflicted over how to preemptively address this and doesn't seem to have any clear-cut plan. A few countries have dispatched military forces to transit states Mali and Niger for anti-terrorist purposes, while some are also considering paying these states and other regional ones to incentivize their governments to stop illegal immigrants at their borders instead of letting them cross through to North Africa and thenceforth Europe. A hybrid solution of sorts is for the EU to cut a Turkish-like migrant deal that includes a combination of so-called disembarkation centers and de facto bribes, but it's unclear how successful that would be if it's ever even implemented. What Trump's suggestions seem to imply is that more stringent border measures need to be in place as far away from Europe as possible in order to most successfully thwart these future immigrant waves, which would basically make Mali, Niger, and possibly also Mauritania, Chad, and Sudan the EU's so-called frontline states instead of Spain, Italy, Malta, and Greece. But getting them to cooperate with any such plans will entail having to overcompensate them for the socio-political and financial costs that they'll have to undertake in that case. This is a serious burden upon states that could ordinarily care less about dealing with this problem. And they're also prone to resort to heavy-handed measures that contradict the EU's human rights gospel if they even do choose to respond. Ironically, the end result might be that the EU's democracy and human rights utopia is ultimately upheld by Brussels bribing anti-democratic states to carry out humanitarian crimes against migrants. Our runner-up is the opposition's surprise win in the Maldives presidential elections last weekend. Ibrahim Mohamed Soleh trounced President Abdullah Yameen by a 16-point margin, even though the US, India, and many Western countries fear-mongered that the incumbent would resort to vote rigging in order to remain in power. It's for this reason why many of them refused to send election observers, because they felt that this would legitimize the fraudulent activity that they wrongly assumed would occur. But the info war concerning this unrealized scenario didn't stop there. In fact, the US and India also appear to have meddled in the election through provocative statements that could have contributed to shaping the ultimate outcome. For instance, the US threatened to sanction Maldivian officials if any suspected fraud occurred, which could have been interpreted by the population as a signal that further economic restrictions might thenceforth be imposed more broadly upon them too. Not only that, but an influential member of India's ruling BJP, Subramanian Swamy, channeled the spirit of the late John McCain by publicly appealing for his country to invade its much smaller southern neighbor in the name of democracy and human rights. This undoubtedly had an effect on the electorate, many of whom were already dissatisfied with Yameen as it was, and the consequences will probably be far-reaching. The US and India seem to have worked in tandem to shape the international conditions in which the Maldivian election occurred, just as they did 3.5 years prior in January 2015 when Sri Lankan President Rajapaksa was unexpectedly deposed in a similar scenario. Similarly to Sri Lanka at the time, the strategic situation surrounding the Maldives is much larger than the small island state because of its new Cold War implications concerning the Chinese-Indian competition over the Indian Ocean. Yameen was regarded as a close Chinese partner and committed his country to the Silk Road, something that drew India's ire to no end, given the Maldives' strategic location right on its doorstep and astride some of the world's most important sea lines of communication. The new government will probably move swiftly to pardon former president and notorious critic of China Mohammad Nasheed as it pivots towards India, though it shouldn't be taken for granted that the Maldives will automatically turn into an Indian satellite as a result. China avoided this outcome with Sri Lanka by shrewdly engaging with the post-Rajapaksa government of President Sirisena, so it's possible that it could pull off the same diplomatic feat with the post-Yameen Maldives too. Another point is that the Maldives security services were considered to be very closely aligned with the incumbent, so it's unclear whether the country's deep state will go along with any pivot that subjugates them to their larger northern neighbor. Through a combination of what might be deep state wars and deft Chinese diplomacy, the Maldives might avoid losing its strategic independence after this shock electoral upset and the country's seemingly impending consequent pivot towards India. But as with everything in international relations, nothing can be entirely assured. At our top spot, we've got the terrorist attack in the Iranian province of Khuzestan. A military parade in the regional capital of Avaz, led by the country's elite Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps to commemorate the Iran-Iraq War, also known as the First Gulf War, was ambushed by terrorists who ended up killing 25 people and injuring over twice as many, with many of the casualties being women and children. Tehran immediately blamed the US, Israel, and the Gulf monarchies for involvement in this killing spree. And although they all denied any role in it, it didn't help any that Trump's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, spoke at the so-called 2018 Iranian Uprising Summit alongside the co-leader of the MEK, which was previously listed as a terrorist organization by the US up until a few years ago, on the same day as the attack, and bragged about wanting to carry out regime change against the Islamic Republic. Nikki Haley immediately clarified that he wasn't speaking in a professional capacity representative of the US government, though it's hard to imagine that he wasn't channeling the highest levels of strategic thought in the Trump administration. Presuming that the US does indeed want to overthrow the Iranian government through a combination of sanctions, color revolutions, and military defections like Giuliani implied, then last weekend's terrorist attack undoubtedly attempts to further those plans, whether America had a direct hand in carrying it out or not. Khuzestan is a minority Arab province abutting Iraq, which previously experienced a Baghdad-supported terrorist separatist campaign during the First Gulf War, which is why the recent attack was so symbolic, because the so-called Awaz National Resistance also claimed responsibility for it too. Daesh said the same thing, but the group is known for pretending to be much stronger and widespread than it is nowadays for public relations purposes, so its claims of responsibility aren't credible. Proceeding from the plausible presumption that the terrorists are more likely to be self-declared separatists than Daesh, then it's probable that this attack was meant to catalyze identity conflict in Iran, between the Persian majority, mostly inhabiting the center of the country, and one of its minority groups in the periphery, thereby following the law of hybrid war, which states that external provocations could exacerbate pre-existing identity fault lines. That doesn't, however, mean that this attempt will be successful, though it'll expectedly form part of the forward info war on the country designed to craft the international perception that people are rising up against the regime, especially coming as it did on the heels of a renewed upsurge in Kurdish terrorism inside of Iran too. Targeting Khuzestan was actually, in hindsight, a somewhat strategic action by the terrorists and their patron because of the symbolic significance that could be extracted from this attack as it relates to perception management and info wars. A supplementary point is that it may have also been designed to provoke the security services into overreacting against the Arab minority there and thus falling into the typical anti-terrorist trap that afflicts all victimized countries in having to walk the fine line between kinetic and non-kinetic responses to these threats so as to not inadvertently catalyze the same reaction that they're trying to suppress, nor generate legitimate grievances that could then be exploited. Altogether, the recent terrorist attack was part of a devious hybrid war strategy, but its prospects for success are limited. Alright folks, so this wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown, and as I always do, I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for tuning into my program. Hope you all have a nice rest of your weekend, and tune in again next week. Thank you. Bye.